We wish to thank the makers of Raleigh Cigarettes, sponsors of Paul Sullivan, for relinquishing their regular time tonight, during which we will present an address by the President of the United States. Paul Sullivan will be heard tonight only 15 minutes later, following President Roosevelt's talk.
The White House, Washington, D.C. Tonight, the President of the United States speaks to the 9th Annual New York Herald Tribune Forum. President Roosevelt is the final speaker on this closing session, which is devoted to the topic, The War's Challenge to the United States. This is John Charles Daly speaking from the Oval Room in the White House. One or two of the day's activities in Washington, for this is a day of important developments. The Senate kept in session until past dinner time, and then at last agreed to vote on the neutrality bill before recessing tomorrow. Climaxing 4 weeks of debate, that vote tomorrow afternoon or night will determine, so far as the Senate is concerned, whether the arms embargo is to be repealed. Before the session ended tonight at 7:15, Majority Leader Barkley obtained unanimous consent to further limitation of debate. No senator is to speak more than 20 minutes on the bill and 20 minutes on each amendment. Today, the administration forces in the Senate scored eight test votes. The Downey Amendment, which would ban all exports of arms in peace or wartime, was beaten 55 to 27. The Danaher Amendment, to continue the arms embargo to prevent at least the export of poison gas and flamethrowers, was defeated 54 to 36. A voice vote also killed the Danaher Amendment to embargo bombing planes and bombers. The Taft Amendment to stop any government agency from making a loan to aid exports to a belligerent, proposals to be rejected. Only one significant addition to the bill was made. At the behest of Senator Tobey of New Hampshire, it was agreed to make it unlawful for foreign ships to fly the American flag to evade attack at sea. The penalty is the closing of American ports to such ships for 3 months. The Russian government this evening announced the release of the American ship City of Flint, which entered the Arctic harbor of Murmansk under a German flag and prize crew. Was a ship sailed with its prize crew or under the American flag was a matter not cleared up. Mystery has swathed all the circumstances of this ship since it penetrated into Soviet jurisdiction. Berlin reports say that a German crew is in charge of the ship, and all the activities in Moscow in the last 24 hours lead officials here to incline toward this presumption. Earlier in the day, Secretary Hull disclosed that the United States had demanded the release of the ship to its American crew in accordance with the Hague Convention of 1907. This pact prohibits a prize from being brought into a neutral port unless the vessel is in distress. But by saying the ship did have machinery trouble and then ordering it to leave, the Russians may have washed their hands of the affair, leaving the ship with the Germans. Then Secretary of Commerce Harry Hopkins initiated another American step today to promote what he calls two-way trade between the United States and all the Latin American countries. He invited their ambassadors and ministers, or designated representatives, to confer with leaders of retail distribution, Commerce Department officials, and heads of other government agencies. If we are to sell our goods to our Latin American neighbors, said Mr. Hopkins, they must have the exchange with which to buy them. This can only come about by buying their goods. The observance of Navy Day tomorrow was commended by the President in a letter to Acting Secretary of the Navy, Mr. Edison. With a world in arms, said Mr. Roosevelt's letter, this country is compelled as never before to maintain an adequate and positive defense. And the Executive Committee on Refugees held a final meeting today and determined to continue its surveys to find all possible openings for the permanent settlement of involuntary migrants, in various parts of the world. The first studies, however, will be to find homes for German political refugees. And that is a resume of the news that was made here in Washington today. And now we come back to our present scene, the Oval Room of the White House, where President Roosevelt awaits the signal to commence his address, the final address on the New York Herald Tribune Forum. This Oval Room, in which the President is to speak tonight, is known as the Diplomatic Reception Room, and as such is used as the reception room for ambassadors and ranking ministers of foreign countries and the ranking officers of the Army and Navy, the generals and the admirals of our own Army and Navy who are introduced into the White House through this entrance. It's a sort of a question of etiquette involved. Attachés and lesser officials of foreign legations and embassies have to use the east entrance, and likewise under officers of the Army and Navy. Those not of general rank are requested to use the east entrance, and of course the front entrance is used by the cabinet. And now this oval room, which we are in, has not as yet evolved a history of its own. In it is the furniture that used to be in the old Red Room upstairs in the days of President Lincoln, but that furniture is now somewhat antique. And although it's not in the room just now, the room has been cleared for President Roosevelt's address. When it is here, it sort of adds a glamour to this room, which is in itself an old room, a room that can carry easily the antiquity and the sort of polished veneer that comes with the age to a furniture and with age to a room. On the walls of the room hang large portraits of past presidents and the wives of past presidents, and in one quarter of the room, as is natural, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Mrs. Reed, ladies and gentlemen of the Herald Tribune Forum, I am glad to say a word in this forum because I heartily approve the forum idea. After all, two 18th century forums in Philadelphia gave to us the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. It is the magic of radio that has so greatly increased the usefulness of the forum. Radio listeners have learned to discriminate over the air between the honest advocate who relies on truth and logic and the more dramatic speaker who is clever in appealing to the passions and prejudices of his listeners. We have had an example of objective reporting during the recent weeks in the presentation of international subjects, both in the press and the radio. Right here, I should like to throw bouquets to the majority of the press and the radio. Through a period of grave anxiety, both have tried to discriminate between fact and propaganda and unfounded rumor, and to give to their readers and listeners an unbiased and factual chronicle of developments. This has worked so well in international reporting that one may be pardoned for wishing for more of it in the field of domestic news. It's a good rule. If it is a good rule in one, why is it not a good rule in the other? From the end of the World War, 21 years ago, this country, like many others, went through a phase of having large groups of people carried away by some emotion, some alluring, attractive, even speciously inspiring public presentation of a nostrum, a cure-all. Many Americans lost their heads because several plausible fellows lost theirs in expounding schemes to end barbarity, to give weekly handouts to people, to give everybody a better job, or, more modestly, for example, to put a chicken or two in every pot, all by adoption of some new financial plan or some new social system. And all of them burst like bubbles. Some proponents of nostrums were honest and sincere. Others, too many of them, were seekers of personal power. Still others saw a chance to get rich on the dimes and quarters of the poorer people in our population. All of them, perhaps unconsciously, were capitalizing the fact that the democratic form of government works slowly, that there always exists in a democratic society a large group which quite naturally champs at the bit over the slowness of democracy. And that is why it is right for us who believe in democracy to keep the democratic processes progressive, in other words, moving forward with the advances in civilization. And that is why it is dangerous for democracy to stop moving forward, because any period of stagnation, of standing still, increases the number of those who demand action and action now. There are, therefore, two distinct dangers to democracy. The peril from those who seek the fulfillment of fine ideals at a pace that is too fast for the machinery of the modern body politic to function. People who, by insistence on too great speed, foster an oligarchic form of government. A form of government such as communism, or Nazism, or fascism. And the other group that presents an equal danger is composed of what is really a small minority that complains that the democratic processes are inefficient as well as being too slow. People, in other words, who would have the whole of their government put into the hands of a little group of those who have proved their efficiency, but only in lines of specialized science or specialized private business and do not see the picture as a whole. They equally, and in most cases unconsciously too, are in effect advocating the oligarchic form of government, communism or Nazism or fascism. Extreme rightists and extreme leftists ought not to be taken out by us and shot against the wall, because people like that sharpen the argument and make us realize the value of the democratic middle course, especially if that middle course, in order to keep up with the times, is, and I quote what I've said before, just a little bit left of center. I am reminded of four definitions. A radical is a man with both feet firmly planted in the air. A conservative is a man with two perfectly good legs who, however, has never learned to walk forward. A reactionary is a somnambulist walking backwards. But a liberal is a man who uses his legs and his hands at the behest, at the command of his head. It's been a good thing for us that during the past 20 years, we have seen the effect of organized propaganda, even when that propaganda has been based on nostrums or prejudices. It has been a good thing for our country that the Congress of the United States has been deluged from time to time by organized propaganda. Members of the House of Representatives and the Senate begin to discriminate nowadays between honest, spontaneous, unsolicited expressions of opinion on the part of the voters and the propaganda type of mass appeals. Because the country is so profoundly interested in the world situation today, I do want to leave with you one thought bearing on internationally interested in the world situation today. I do want to leave with you one thought bearing on international relations. I make bold to do this because the topic of this evening's discussion, as I understand it, is the war's challenge to the United States. In and out of Congress, we have heard orators and commentators and others beating their breasts and proclaiming against sending the boys of American mothers to fight on the battlefields of Europe. That I do not hesitate to label as one of the worst fakes of Europe. That I do not hesitate to label as one of the worst fakes in current history. It is a deliberate setting up of an imaginary bogeyman. The simple truth is that no person, No person in any responsible place in the national administration in Washington, or in any state government, or in any city government, or in any county government, has ever suggested, in any shape, manner, or form, the remotest possibility of sending the boys of American mothers to fight on the battlefields of Europe. And that is why I label that argument as a shameless and dishonest fake. I have not the slightest objection to make against those amateurs who, to the reading and the listening public, discourse on the inner meanings of the military and naval events of the war in Europe. They do no harm because the average citizen is acquiring rapidly the gift of discrimination. And the more all these subjects are talked about by amateur armchair strategists, the more the public will make up its own mind in the long run. The public, the American voting public, will acquire the ability to think things through for themselves. The fact of the international situation, the world situation, the simple fact without any bogey in it, without any appeals to prejudice, is that the United States of America, as I have said before, is neutral and does not intend to get involved in war. That we can be neutral in thought as well as in act is impossible of fulfillment because, again, the people of this country, thinking things through calmly and without prejudice, have been and are making up their minds about the relative merits of current events on other continents. It is a fact increasingly manifest that presentation of real news has sharpened the minds and the judgment of men and women everywhere in these days of real public discussion. We Americans begin to know the difference between the truth on the one side and the falsehood on the other. No matter how often the falsehood is iterated and reiterated. My friends, remember that repetition does not transform a lie into a truth.
And so the President of the United States concludes his broadcast to the 9th Annual New York Herald Tribune Forum from the White House in Washington, D.C. John Charles Daly speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.